Welcome to the History of California podcast. I'm your host, Jordan Maddox. Today, we're continuing our story of California and the Civil War. Let's get started. In this episode, we are going to discuss the social and political life in California during the Civil War. There was a moment early on in the war that things could have taken a decisive turn. If the Confederate Army had successfully invaded the Southwest and made it to California, there were contingents of Southern sympathizers there present and waiting, and some outright Confederate allies ready to pick up arms and fight. A hot war in California certainly would have created a series of ripple effects, not only in the West, but also across the rest of the country, as politicians would have needed to decide how to allocate resources to defend this important part of the Union. Alas, though, this did not happen. The Confederate mission in the Southwest failed, leaving California protected and Confederate sympathizers isolated from the rest of the Confederacy. If you remember from prior episodes discussing the Shiv influence and dominance in state politics, you probably remember how important a role they played even though they were a minority in the state. That influence began to decline as the Civil War picked up pace. The presence of military authorities in California was certainly a limiting factor in the ability of pro-Southern contingents to organize. The two generals who were in charge in California, General Sumner and General Wright, were tasked with monitoring and maintaining peace in the West. There were a number of hotspots that they needed to monitor, specifically in Southern California, in order to avoid a hot conflict. In Richard Hurley's book, which has been an amazing guide and repository of knowledge for this specific series on California and the Civil War, he covers one such hotspot in California, Visalia. Located in the Central Valley at the base of the Sierra Nevadas, Visalia was a prime access point to gold country in the mountains. The town had both pro-Southern and pro-Union contingents. It was hardly a peaceful place. Fortunately, a lot of the fighting took place in ink, not in blood. Like many towns across America even today, Visalia had competing newspapers that catered to two different perspectives. The Equal Rights Expositor was one of those papers. It was a pro-Southern paper that parroted mild forms of the rhetoric from the Confederacy. To the military government's credit, they allowed the Expositor to continue to operate even during the heat of fighting, not wanting to set a precedent that the right of freedom of speech should be limited even in a time of war. However, that even-handed approach did not last long. First, General Wright attacked distribution, preventing the postmaster from delivering the newspapers. Then, he stationed a group of volunteers in a camp near Visalia as an explicit threat to seeming or serious secessionists that the military would not be afraid to take action if things got out of hand. Naturally, the situation escalated, leading to two of the editors of the Expositor being jailed, and eventually the office and the equipment of the newspaper being destroyed. Visalia was not an isolated incident, and conflicts over newspapers were a flashpoint in California. Meanwhile, Union-supporting newspapers continued to operate with seemingly no limits. However, some Union newspapers were forced to relocate for the safety of their editors and publishers if they happened to be working in a pro-Southern region of the state. The ultimate result of all this conflict over newspapers was a withdrawal of the secessionist perspective from the world of publishing in California, which many might argue was a positive thing for the world of politics in the region. And in many ways, I agree, in large part because it wasn't the government shutting down these particular papers, but rather public opinion changing and the consolidation of Southern sympathizers into specific strongholds. Consequently, there was less of an appetite for that perspective. In other words, the market brought an end to many of these newspapers, not the government. In terms of state politics, the Shiv-leaning Democrats lost their control in large part due to the alliance between the northern-leaning Democrats and the Republican alignment at the state level. The alliance between these two political parties did not mean that there was an agreement on key issues. And there certainly were issues that were explosive in California. While northern-leaning Democrats did not support secession, they were deeply racist and did not believe that black Americans should acquire any additional rights or gain any or even a small amount of political power in California. Additionally, the subset of Democrats would have been comfortable pursuing even peace at the expense of the union's integrity. Racism was also common in the ranks of Republicans, and there were certainly a number of diverse opinions for how the conflict should end nationwide. Some of the issues that would turn out to be divisive in California were more related to personal liberties than the outcome of the Civil War. While in many northern states, the draft remained the crux of conflict, in California, state leaders passed a number of laws that attempted to restrict those who held different opinions about how much power that the secessionist-leaning Californians should have and how much they could participate in California's economy and society. The legislature created oaths of loyalty for certain forms of employment, as well as creating onerous legal restrictions for Shivs specifically, amongst other forms of disenfranchisement. However, much of this was more bark than bite, in part because Californians, given their frontier history and deep individualism, mostly saw laws as perfunctory and not terribly important to enforce. Alas, the most that came from these legal threats were a few important Shiv Democrats being thrown in Alcatraz for a small amount of time. One of the most important statewide elections during the Civil War was the election of 1863. And in particular, this election gives us an impression of the political state of mind of California in the middle of the Civil War. The election for governor of California was between John Downey, who we discussed in a previous episode and was originally a Shiv Democrat, but switched alliances when Fort Sumter was attacked, but who became disillusioned with the war as the death toll started to pile up. And on the other side, Frederick Low, representing the Republican Party and who would resoundingly defeat Downey in this election. Frederick Low would serve as governor of California from 1863 to 1867. He was born near Frankfort, Maine, and his parents were farmers. Low was able to attend school and from there moved to Boston, where he worked in a mercantile house as a counter. To complement his traditional education, he was also an autodidact and attended lectures with various organizations in the area. Like many people, with the news of the gold rush, Low packed his stuff and headed west, taking the Panama ship, that being the name of the ship, around South America and pitching a tent on California Street in San Francisco when he arrived. He worked in various business enterprises in California, both in stores and later attempting to consolidate inland water transportation. Having made a lot of money from his business enterprises, he moved to San Francisco from Marysville, where his business was located. He took the capital from his business enterprises and funneled it into a new occupation as an investor. Typically, when one has enough money, the usual next pursuit is political power. So in 1861, Low ran unsuccessfully for state controller. However, he found success soon after when he was nominated as a congressman for California. He took the third most votes in the state for Congress, where there were three seats available. He served for roughly a year and then was appointed the collector of San Francisco. The custom house that he managed was not only financially important, but it was also important for the defense of the San Francisco harbor. He leveraged the importance of this federal position to win the election for governor against the incumbent Leland Stanford. Now, we haven't spent much time discussing Stanford for a reason. He's an important figure in California history, and we will spend time discussing him. However, I am saving that for our next section on railroads. Within that section, we will discuss his time as governor during the early years of the Civil War, but within the larger task of understanding his biography. In terms of how Governor Lowe used his time in office, the first thing that was important was his promise to use his veto power to defeat things that he said were, quote, inconsistent with fundamental law or with public welfare, end quote. This was in reference to prior legislation that had been passed that were either relief in nature or were rent-seeking behavior like granting franchises and special privileges. If you're unfamiliar with the concept of rent-seeking behavior, it comes from economics and it refers to actions that individuals or groups take to increase their wealth without creating new wealth. It's asking for a, quote, bigger slice of the pie and not offering to bake a new pie, end quote. We see this most often today in lobbying efforts to get tax breaks or regulations put in place that benefit certain companies at the expense of others. Not only is this an inefficient use of resources, it also is highly corrupt and leads to politicians giving kickbacks to their friends or those who donate to them. In terms of economics, Lowe wanted to support the federal government's deficits as it was paying for an expensive war by getting rid of some of this rent-seeking behavior in California. The path beyond vetoing laws that would be corrupt and be giving extra benefits to people was to increase mining revenues and agricultural production. With these two initiatives in mind, he approached his time as governor. Lowe was a man of his word and made good on his promise to veto a number of bills that he perceived to be giving special benefits to individuals and groups. One example of this kind of veto is the Eureka Drainage Company, who is seeking exclusive privileges in the state. He vetoed this, even with dramatic pushback by the company. Overall, the legislative session during Lowe's term was successful in reducing deficits, but also redirecting surplus funds to give extra pay to California volunteer soldiers. The financial situation was going well in California, but then, with the end of the Civil War, that would change. We will discuss this in future episodes, particularly as we discuss the Reconstruction in California. Finally, we can also draw some conclusions about California during this time by looking at the presidential election of 1864. Lincoln was the Republican nominee and incumbent. George McClellan, the famous general, was the Democratic nominee. The margins were fairly large in California. Lincoln took 58.6% of the vote, which translates to roughly 62,000 votes, and McClellan received roughly 41% of the vote, which translates to about 44,000 votes. The map of the county swings in terms of votes are illustrative of broader patterns that we've discussed in the past. Lincoln's support was based mainly in Northern California and along the Central Coast, where McClellan's support was concentrated in Southern California with a few sparsely populated Northern Coast counties. Nationwide numbers were similar, but a little bit more evenly divided. In terms of popular vote nationwide, Lincoln received 55% of the vote, or roughly 2.2 million votes, and McClellan received 44% of the vote, or roughly 1.8 million. The electoral tally, however, was not nearly as close, with McClellan receiving 21 electoral votes to Lincoln's 212 electoral votes. Obviously, this electoral count did not include the Southern Confederate states that were at war with the North, which makes the closeness of the popular vote that much more interesting in that it demonstrates fairly clearly how divided the North was on the strategy of the war, even if the Republicans controlled majorities in these Northern states. In that sense, California was following nationwide patterns but with slightly larger margins. Hopefully this episode gives you a better perspective and picture of California during the Civil War from a societal and political perspective. We will see you next time.